I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. My guest is the actor and activist George Takei, one of the most recognizable actors on the planet. His career spans 60 years and includes his iconic portrayal as Hikaru Sulu of the Starship Enterprise. At the age of 82, he is also a powerful and influential voice for social justice. As a child, Mr. Takei and his family were among the 120,000 people of Japanese descent who were imprisoned by the U.S. government during the Second World War. Mr. Takei has written an illustrated memoir about that experience entitled They Called Us Enemy. Plus, President Trump spent the weekend playing golf and calling us names as Congressman Elijah Cummings calls him out for violating the Constitution. I'll have some reflections on bullying Baltimore. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Before I welcome our guest today, a word about the events this weekend that began with the president singling out our city and Representative Elijah Cummings, the chair of the House Oversight Committee, with scornful, racist, and ludicrous comments to his beloved Twitter followers. Among other statements, Mr. Trump called Congressman Cummings racist. We invited the congressman to join us on Midday today, not to discuss the president's tweets, which are absurd on their face, but rather to talk about his committee's focus in the oversight process. He is not available to be with us. Last Thursday, the House Oversight Committee, along party lines, voted to subpoena email and text messages from the president's daughter and son-in-law, Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner. Mr. Cummings told the New York Times, quote, "The committee has obtained direct evidence that multiple high-level White House officials have been violating the Presidential Records Act by using personal email accounts, text messaging services, and even encrypted applications for official business, and not preserving those records in compliance with federal law. What we do not yet know is why these White House officials were attempting to conceal these communications," end quote. The Oversight, Intelligence, and Judiciary Committees, as well as federal law enforcement and authorities, will continue their investigations into the Trump administration, the 2016 Trump campaign, the Trump Inaugural Committee, and the Trump Foundation. And as always, we will continue to cover those investigations on this program. We have discussed Mr. Trump's racism on multiple occasions here on Midday. And that subject may very well come up again today with my guest, the actor George Takei. Mr. Takei's new book is about the racial bigotry of another president, Franklin Roosevelt, a president who is revered for ending the Depression and successfully prosecuting the war effort in the 1940s. And, of course, we will continue to cover what President Trump does. And we will try to be careful about falling into the trap of focusing inordinately on what the president tweets. With all due respect to those on social media who are posting pleasant pictures of Maryland's 7th Congressional District to counter the president's comments, and those who are posting pictures of the blight and disrepair that those of us who live in this district know all too well, I am, Mr. President, one of those human beings who does want to live here. Proving Mr. Trump wrong misses the point. Holding Mr. Trump and other political leaders accountable for solving the problems that attend cities from Baltimore to Gilroy, California, is what matters most. On Wednesday on this program, we will continue our series Midday in the Neighborhood, in which we meet people who live in the 7th District and elsewhere and find out from them, the people who really know, what's going on in their communities. The roots of many of the problems many cities face can be found in racial inequity and intolerance. And one of the things that we can do to understand and address the problem of racial intolerance is to make an effort to understand history. My guest today has made an important contribution to that effort. The actor and activist George Takei has a career that spans 60 years, which includes his iconic role as Hikaru Sulu in the Star Trek television series and movies. He has also become an influential and powerful voice for social justice, marriage equality, and LGBTQ rights. Earlier this month, Mr. Takei published an illustrated memoir about his experience with his family being incarcerated by the United States government in internment camps during the Second World War. Mr. Takei, his parents, and his two younger siblings were among 120,000 people of Japanese descent who were imprisoned during the war, and his memoir deftly illuminates the effect of the stress and hardship of that experience. The book is They Called Us Enemy. George Takei joins us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. We'll take your calls a little bit later in the program. In the meantime, you are welcome to join us via email and Twitter, midday@wypr.org, and you can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. George Takei, welcome to the show, and thank you for your patience as I got a couple of things off my chest.
Well, it's good to be talking with you. Excuse me. In Baltimore, I have fond memories of the various stages of the Inner Harbor becoming the dazzling place it became and what it is today. So I have good feelings about what's going on and how you are responding to that. Occupant of the White House is ill-advised and quite uneducated comments.
Well, we appreciate that indeed. Introduce us to your family. Tell us about your mom and your dad and your two younger siblings, Henry and Nancy.
Well, my mother was born in Sacramento, California. My father was born in Japan, right at the foot of Mount Fuji, a town called Yamanashi, a province called Yamanashi. But his mother passed when he was very young. And my widower grandfather decided to come to America with his two boys, my father being the younger. And he immigrated to San Francisco with his two boys. My father was born in Japan, but he was reared in San Francisco and educated in San Francisco, went to college there, and felt very much American. But he could not become an American citizen because there was a ban on Asians immigrating to the United States. They were denied naturalized citizenship. So although my father felt very American, he could not become a naturalized citizen. My parents met and married in Los Angeles, and my brother, younger brother Henry, was born here, and my baby sister was an infant at the time that we were incarcerated. I was 5 years old at the time, and in my graphic memoir, I am depicted by this wonderfully gifted artist, Harmony Becker. I love her name, Harmony, and what she does with her amazing gift as a illustrator, a manga comic drawer, is really extraordinary. I become an irresistibly adorable 5-year-old boy.
Yes, you do. Yes, sir, you do indeed. And the book is really beautiful. And it's interesting, as I read it, I imagined what it would be like reading this in a regular book form. I think the decision to make it a graphic memoir is an interesting one. And was that a decision that you made early on in the process? I mean, this is just such a heartbreaking story of your family's experience and then writ large, the experience of so many people, literally 120,000 other people of Japanese descent. Did you have to make a choice to decide to write it as a straight book or a graphic novel? How did you, or a graphic memoir? How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, actually, I wrote my autobiography, which was published in 1994, called To the Stars, and I told that same story then. On paper with letters. It was the retelling of that same story, but I'm still shocked when I tell people that I consider well-informed about my childhood imprisonment, and they're shocked. Their shock shocks me, because I thought people knew about my childhood imprisonment, and yet a large number of Americans don't know this chapter of American history.
Yeah.
And so I thought another way of telling this story might be in a comic book form, because I grew up on comic books, and that's an easy way for young people to get to know the story. So this is aiming at the young readership, teenagers and young adults, because it's at that age that people are absorbing in all the information that they acquire, and they grow up with it, and that information becomes a part of their body. And I thought this is an important way to reach the future of America. Young people who grow up knowing this chapter of American history and mindful of it. It's a part of their knowledge of American history. And so we thought this might be another way to build the future of America with this knowledge. And by having a large number of people, voters and participants in our democracy, aware of this, then the kind of things that's happening now would be overruled by the majority of Americans. It's because we have so many people that don't know. And the other worrisome thing is that they don't participate in our election, a participatory part of our democracy.
Sure, an estimated 74 million people didn't vote in 2016.
Yeah, and absolutely. Look how what we wound up with.
Yeah. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today, George Takei. His new graphic memoir is called They Called Us Enemy. We'll take your phone calls a little later if you want to get online. That you're welcome to do that. You can also drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, and you can tweet us at @MiddayWIPR. You are careful not to refer to the camps your family was sent to, and there were three different ones, as Japanese internment camps. That is a term phrase that a lot of people use to describe those places. But you have very strong feelings about why that is an inaccurate description.
Absolutely. It drives me up the wall, because just plain English grammar would lead you to think that the phrase or the words Japanese internment camp would be run by the Japanese government. We were Americans of Japanese ancestry, incarcerated in American internment camps here in the United States, guarded by the U.S. military, ordered by the President of the United States. These were American concentration camps. I will call it that, because that's the definition of the word concentration camp, to concentrate people of a common heritage, race, culture, or faith in barbed wire encampment for political purposes. That's what they were. I'm very careful about not using the words concentration camp in my one-hour talks at college universities, because I talk for 45 minutes and I have 15 minutes for a Q&A. But I've found that when I use the word concentration camp to describe the camps that we were in, all it takes is one person of Jewish ancestry to tell us about his or her family's horrific, atrocious loss. And the 15 minutes for discussion is taken up by that subject. I want to emphasize that I'm not comparing the two incidents historic incidents. The intent of our incarceration was to confine us for political purposes. The Nazi camps were confining people of a common faith with the intent to annihilate all of the people of that faith. The intent was extermination. Those camps very properly should be called death camps or extermination camps, because that was the purpose of those camps. The purpose of the barbed wire prison camps that we were in were for political purposes. There was no charge, there was no trial. Due process, the central pillar of our justice system, simply disappeared. The nation was swept up by war hysteria and racism, and we were incarcerated for a political purpose. And when the war was over, the gates were thrown open, and we were, in quotes, freed. But
at which point you had to rebuild a life from scratch, having lost everything.
After we were impoverished and imprisoned, sure. Yes.
And you were moved to as I mentioned, more than one location, not all in California. You ended up in Arkansas for a little while. Where was your camp? Where was your family imprisoned?
Well, first we were the camps were being built. President Roosevelt signed the executive order on February 19th, 1942. And the construction of the camps, there were 10 camps altogether, commenced. But they rounded us up before the camps were ready. And so we in Los Angeles were taken to San Anita Racetrack and herded over to the stable area. And each family was assigned a horse stall to live in while the camps were being built. It was still pungent with the smell of horse manure. And so for my parents, going from a two-bedroom house on Garnet Street in Los Angeles and taking their three children into a smelly horse stall was a degrading, depressing, and painful experience. But for me, as a five-year-old kid, I thought it was fun to sleep where the horses sleep. So in my graphic memoir, I tell a parallel story to tell my story, the five-year-old kid's story. Honestly, I have to depict that experience that I had as a exciting adventure of discovery for my father and mother. That parallel experience, that same experience, was a devastating, humiliating, painful, anguishing experience.
Sure, and we'll take up a conversation about your parents, your dad in particular, this poignant relationship with your father as you spoke to him later in life when this experience was over, and the insights that you gained to yourself and from him. The actor and activist and author George Takei is my guest. He has nearly 3 million Twitter followers. He has served as a spokesperson for the Human Rights Campaign Coming Out Project, and he was awarded the Order of the Rising Sun Gold Rays with Rosette by the Japanese government for his contributions to U.S. and Japanese relations. His new book is They Called Us Enemy, an illustrated memoir about his family's experience being imprisoned in American internment camps during the Second World War. We'll have more with George Takei after a quick break, and we'll start taking your calls and comments. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, a conversation about the principles and concepts of the United States Constitution, the bedrock of our democracy and one of the most significant documents in human history. University of Baltimore law professor Kim Whaley is the author of a masterfully crafted how-to guide to understanding our framework for democracy called How to Read the Constitution and Why. Kim Whaley joins me on Midday tomorrow, and coming up Wednesday, it's another installment of Midday in the Neighborhood. As always, we welcome your input to this series. If you'd like to tell the story of your community, send an email to midday@wypr.org, and one of our producers will be in touch to invite you to appear on our program. If you've just joined us today, my guest is the pioneering actor, activist, and author George Takei. We're talking about his new book, an illustrated memoir entitled They Called Us Enemy. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780, our email midday at wipr.org. To send us a tweet, it's at midday WIPR. Mr. Takei, the relationship with your father, you talk early in the book about how your father really bore the brunt of the pain and the anguish when your family was incarcerated and moved around the country. After you mentioned before the break that you were at the Santa Anita racetrack for a while they were building these internment camps, then you were moved to Arkansas to a place called Rowere. And then later on, you came back to California to the Tula Lake Relocation Center up in Northern California. You eventually settled in Los Angeles when you were released. But the conversations you had with your father as a young man, as a high school age kid, where you were arguing with your father about why did he even agree to let the authorities take you away, that's one of the most poignant parts of this graphic memoir.
Yes, looking back on it, you know, I really cherish those conversations, as well as regret some of the things I said as a passionate and idealistic kid. When I became a teenager, I began reading voraciously any history book I could get my hand on, or civics books. I didn't find anything about our incarceration mentioned in those books. But in the civics books, I read about some of the ideals of our justice system. All men are created equal, equal justice under the law. This is a nation ruled by laws. I couldn't understand why and how that was possible. And this was at the time of the Civil Rights Movement, and I heard on the radio speeches by people like Dr. Martin Luther King, and I was moved by them. And I said, Daddy, I would have protested. I would have organized my friends at school and gone downtown to the federal department. And my father said, yes, I can visualize you doing that. But I had to think about your mother, your brother, your sister, and you. They were pointing guns at me. If something happened to me, can you imagine what might happen to you guys? And I understood that, but I still maintain that it was wrong. And my father started to tell me about our democracy. My father was an unusual man. Most parents, Japanese-American parents of my parents' generation, did not talk about the internment after the war for understandable reasons. They were so hurt and wounded and felt shame, which was wrongly placed. The shame was the government's, not theirs, but they were the victims, and so many victims take on that shame. And so they didn't want to inflict that to their children. But my father, and I guess, you know, when an immigrant learns about our system, our democracy, they really take it to heart. My father told me that ours is a people's democracy, and the people have the capacity to do extraordinary things, those noble ideals of our democracy that you talk about. They were created by people, people that had a vision for our country. But the people are also fallible human beings, and they make mistakes. He said to me, President Roosevelt, back in the 30s, was a great president. He was able to use the power of the presidency and his problem-solving capacity and his political savvy and create jobs and pull the nation up from a devastating depression.
Yeah, and you do talk about the complexities of understanding and appreciating Roosevelt, because obviously he was the one who signed the order, famous order 9066, which led to everybody's incarceration. So that was an interesting part of the book to me, your, I thought, very balanced appraisal of
FDR. He said that he was a great president, but he was also a human being with all the fallibilities. And when a president makes a mistake, he makes the victims of that mistake go through a catastrophic experience. And so he said, our people's democracy is existentially dependent on people that cherish those ideals to be actively engaged with the process. It's a participatory democracy, and we've got to participate. And I kept saying, Daddy, but Daddy. And so he, one Sunday afternoon, he drove me down to the Adlai Stevenson for President campaign headquarters downtown. And he says, we volunteered, but actually he volunteered me. I just tagged along. And I understood then, working together with all these other volunteers at the headquarters, what it takes and the kind of dedication, the passion to get a great man. Governor Stevenson of Illinois was an eloquent speaker and an inspiring man.
And that began your career as a political activist, which you've kept up.
Exactly.
Now you're 82 years old and you're still at it. and a few years after you were interred, interned. Sorry. You're not interred yet. You're interned.
No,
you
no.
were interned. You got to meet Eleanor Roosevelt, and you talk
yes.
about that as a thrilling experience. Yeah.
It was a fantastic experience, and we met Governor Stevenson, too, albeit it was much briefer than meeting Mrs. Roosevelt. My father happened to be in the headquarters, too, at the same time, but suddenly he didn't feel well, and he excused himself. And I was a little concerned for my father. And that evening, I asked him, are you all right? What? And he told me that he was not comfortable meeting Mrs. Roosevelt.
Yeah, the wife of FDR, sure.
He knew that she was a good lady. She was opposed to the internment, but nevertheless, she was still Mrs. Roosevelt, and he found it very uncomfortable.
And that's completely understandable. The new book is called They Called Us Enemy. George Takei is my guest. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday_WIPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWIPR. Mr. Takei, we do have a couple of calls. Let's go to the first one to Michael in Havre de Grace. He wants to talk a little bit about the Munson Report. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Hello. How are you?
Just great.
I have read the Munson Report. My father gave it to me as a child back in the 60s, and I could never understand why President Roosevelt, maybe he didn't read the Munson Report, but I read it, and its conclusions were that the Japanese were very loyal to their new country.
Exactly.
And we should remind people or tell folks who may not have ever heard of it, this is in the fall of 1941, so early on in the war effort. Special representative to the State Department, Curtis Munson, ordered by Mr. Roosevelt to do an intelligence gathering investigation, and he basically found there is no Japanese problem in California or anywhere else. There's much more danger from communists and others. So that information was available to Mr. Roosevelt, but George Takei, he still decided to issue Order 9066.
There was a tidal wave of war hysteria. In California, we had an attorney general. His name went down in history as a great chief justice of the Supreme Court. His name was Earl Warren. He was the top attorney in the state of California, attorney general. And he had his eyes on the governor's seat. He wanted to run for governor. And he saw that the single most popular political issue in California was the lock up the Japs issue. So this attorney general, who knew the Constitution, who knew the law, but ambition got the hold of him, together with war hysteria, and he got in front of that issue and said, he made an amazing statement. He said, "We have no reports of spying or sabotage or fifth column activities by Japanese Americans." And that is ominous, because the Japanese are inscrutable. That stereotypical word. Because we can't tell what they're thinking, it would be prudent to lock them up before they do anything. So for this attorney general, this top lawyer, the absence of evidence was the evidence. And he got elected governor on that campaign. He was reelected twice, served three terms as the governor of California, and then went on to be appointed Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And so the human element comes into play here. Attorney General Warren knew the law. He was an intelligent man, but ambition got the best of him, and war hysteria that swept the nation. And that hysteria stampeded even President Roosevelt. And he signed that executive order, 9066, that put us innocent people who had nothing to do with Pearl Harbor. We were Americans, and yet we looked like the people that bombed Pearl Harbor, and we were put into these barbed wire prison camps.
And there was a department in the government called the War Relocation Authority. It was run by Dwight Eisenhower's younger brother, Milton S. Eisenhower, who's a former president of Johns Hopkins University here in Baltimore. The library is named after him. And there were loyalty questions asked. That was a mandatory form that everybody in the camps was required to fill out. One of them was about willingness to serve in the armed forces. That was question number 27. And question number 28, would you swear unqualified allegiance to the United States of America? And your father and many others answered no to both of those questions. And there was a term for the people who answered no.
They literally called them the no-nos. Well, you didn't explain the question 28 wholly. That was only half of it. It was two ideas in one sentence. It asked, will you swear your loyalty to the United States of America and forswear your loyalty to the Emperor of Japan? We're Americans. The government presumed that we had an inborn racial loyalty to the emperor, which was insulting. We're Americans. And so if you answered no, meaning I don't have a loyalty to the emperor to forswear, that no applied to the first part of the very same sentence, meant that you're not going to swear your loyalty to the United States. If you answered yes, meaning I do swear my loyalty to the United States, that yes applied to the second part of the same sentence, meant that you were confessing that you had been loyal to the emperor.
Yeah, at one time you were loyal to the
exactly.
emperor.
Exactly. Right, yeah. So please read the whole sentence.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah,
you
fair
just
enough.
Read the
yep.
first part.
Okay, will you swear unqualified allegiance to the United States of America and faithfully defend the United States from any or all attack by foreign or domestic forces and forswear any form of allegiance or obedience to the Japanese emperor, to any foreign government, power, or organization? Yeah, you're quite
now
right.
That's complete.
Yeah, quite right to correct me on that, sir, and I appreciate it. George Takei is my guest. His new book is called They Called Us Enemy. We'll take your calls and comments when we come back from a quick break at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. By the way, on Mondays here on Midday, we usually read the names of those who have lost their lives to violence in our city. But this week, we will acknowledge those victims on Wednesday instead of today. More with George Takei when Midday returns after this break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, our west coast became a potential combat zone. Living in that zone were more than 100,000 persons of Japanese ancestry, two-thirds of them American citizens, one-third aliens. We knew that some among them were potentially dangerous. Most were loyal. But no one knew what would happen among this concentrated population if Japanese forces should try to invade our shores. There were more Japanese in Los Angeles than in any other area. And nearby San Pedro, houses and hotels occupied almost exclusively by Japanese were within a stone's throw of a naval air base, shipyards, oil wells. Japanese fishermen had every opportunity to watch the movement of our ships. Japanese farmers were living close to vital aircraft plants. So, as a first step, all Japanese were required to move from critical areas such as these. Only when circumstances permit the loyal American citizens once again to enjoy the freedom we in this country cherish, and when the disloyal, we hope, have left this country for good. In the meantime, we are setting a standard for the rest of the world in the treatment of people who may have loyalties to an enemy nation. We are protecting ourselves without violating the principles of Christian decency. And we won't change this fundamental decency no matter what our enemies do.
It's an excerpt from a short film produced by the U.S. Office of War Information in 1942 called Japanese Relocation. It was written and narrated by Milton S. Eisenhower, the younger brother of President Dwight D. Eisenhower. More than 120,000 people of Japanese descent were imprisoned in internment camps during World War II. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today is George Takei, who with his family was one of those who were imprisoned. The Takei family was sent to three different camps between 1942 and 1946. His new book, They Called Us Enemy, tells his family's story of those years and his own journey to become one of the most recognizable actors on the planet. Best known for his role as Hikaru Sulu, the helmsman and eventually captain of the Starship Enterprise in the original Star Trek TV series and six subsequent movies, Mr. Takei's acting career spans six decades. The internment camps of the Second World War are also the focus of the second season of AMC's anthology horror series, The Terror, in which Mr. Takei has a recurring role. George Takei joins me from the NPR studios in Culver City, California. You are welcome to join us as well. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. And Mr. Takei, you and other Japanese Americans were sent a check, I guess sometime around 2000.
Well, before you get to that, that recording that you played by Milton Eisenhower, it's again that same sweeping generalization. That why were we living on the coast? Why were we fishing on the coast? Because they were fishermen that came from a fishing province in Japan. Or my grandfather, my maternal grandparents were farmers in the Sacramento Delta. And the question raised was, why were they farming near the high tension wire? Because that was scrap land, and that's all the land that we had to we could work on. With that sweeping characterization, there's something nefarious about where we lived. We were minorities, and we could live in certain parts, all the more in undesirable parts. And so it really gets my blood going when I hear Milton Eisenhower's propaganda. It is the sweeping characterization. We have a system called due process. If someone is guilty, they have to be charged and then have a trial to determine whether that charge is true or not.
And what's so chilling?
In our case, we were all characterized as someone suspicious. We were all categorized as enemy alien. And this, you know, immediately after Pearl Harbor, young Japanese Americans rushed to their recruitment centers, like all young Americans, and volunteered to serve in the U.S. military. This act of patriotism was answered with a slap on the face. They were denied military service and categorized as enemy alien, which was absolutely crazy. They were patriots volunteering for military service. And so after they were denied military service and imprisoned for a year, then the government realized that there was a wartime manpower shortage. And here are all these young people that they could have had, but they are classified as enemy alien. And so that's why they came down with a loyalty questionnaire to justify drafting people out of barbed wire prison camps. It was really one of the most hysterical series of unthinking hysterical assaults on the Japanese Americans.
And it's chilling to think how redolent that rhetoric is that we heard in that excerpt from the film with the rhetoric of Mr. Trump today talking about people
exactly.
on the southern border.
Well, that's why we have to learn from history. And when I meet people that I can, you know, adults that I consider well-informed who don't know this story, it deeply troubles me. And that's why the graphic memoir, so that we can get the story understood by young people who grow up knowing that this is also a part of our history, together with the glorious chapters that we have.
And I want to get your opinion about the notion of reparations. And I guess in 2000, President Clinton did award the Congressional Medal of Honor to several Japanese-American soldiers who served valiantly in the war.
And I was there at the White House when that was granted.
And he talked about the unrepayable debt. Given how Japanese Americans had been treated and the service that they rendered to the country anyway, Japanese Americans were sent money, I guess it's about $20,000, to people whose families were affected by the internments.
This was in 1988, and I was part of the movement to get that apology and redress from the United States government. We lobbied the Congress. I testified at the congressional hearings. And more than four decades after we were imprisoned, President Ronald Reagan, on behalf of the government, officially apologized for what he called a grave mistake. It was a grave mistake. And he signed the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, which pledged a $20,000 token recompense. It was a token. What was lost was much more than that.
Do you think that in any way serves as a model for reparations for African Americans whose ancestors were enslaved?
Well, the situation is different. Mm-hmm. Reparations was paid only to those who were alive at that, the survivors who were alive in 1988. In our family, my father was the one that bore the burden and the pain the most, and he had passed in 1979, too soon. 9 years before, or 8 years, what is it, 1979, 9 years before the apology was to come. He died never knowing. But the token restitution was paid to those who were alive at that time. Mm-hmm. I was a child, so when I got my check, I donated the whole amount to the Japanese American National Museum, which tells the story of the Japanese American experience. I felt that should not be coming to me, but to the telling of that story. To compare that with history of slavery is a totally different story. It's a huge legacy that we have from slavery. That was followed by Jim Crow, and the effects of that is still being felt by African Americans today. But they are not slaves, so it has to have a whole different approach. I think the approach to the African American situation is institutionally, whether it be
rather than individually.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Education systems, so forth.
Yeah. Let's try to get another couple of calls in here if we can. Let's go to Logan in Baltimore. Logan, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you for having me. First, I just really wanted to say real quick, Mr. Takei, it's an absolute honor to be able to speak with you today. I called in because I actually, about 15 years ago, had a discussion with my grandfather on exactly this topic. You know, he has since passed, but he spoke about the Japanese internment. The embarrassment of someone from that generation. He actually fought in World War II and called it a stain upon American history. And I'm glad that you both brought it up with the parallels to today's rhetoric, because as someone from or living in Baltimore, not originally from there, but who has called this town my home, the rhetoric that I heard from Mr. Eisenhower is quite chilling.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Logan. Let's go see if we can go to one more quick call. We just have a couple minutes left to Minna in Baltimore. Minna, welcome to the show.
Well, I guess I have to make it very quick.
Yes, ma'am.
Listening to George Takei reminds me very much of dear friends in Seattle. We went on assignment in 1971. I discovered Japanese flower arranging, Ikebana, and Mary Shigaya was my teacher, and we became very close friends. She and her family were taken to Minidoka. And because she became a good friend, I heard stories from her. I saw the yearbook that was developed in the camp where the neighboring community had ads in the yearbook, which I thought was incredibly odd. There were young men from the camp that were used, they were allowed to leave the camp to work in the the community, because the other men, the American men, I shouldn't say American, the citizens of that town were all at war and they needed help. Mary's father was in the import-export business, and they were fortunate. A friend of theirs, not Japanese, told her father that he would take care of the business and it would be waiting for them when they came back. That was unusual, because many people who had farmlands, wonderful land around Seattle, businesses, they lost it all.
Yes, of course. Well, thank you for that perspective, Min. I appreciate it. And
yes, and I appreciate that too, because that story, there are many stories like that where good people came to share in our situation and make it a little bit bearable.
And Mr. Kay, we just have a few seconds left. I want you to talk a little bit about this show on AMC, which begins its second season next month, called The Terror Infamy. This takes up a familiar topic with you.
Indeed it is. And I welcome the telling of this story, because this series is groundbreaking in its scope, its huge scope. It's a 10-episode miniseries. That means 10 hours spread over a 10-week period to tell this story. And so we're able to go into great depth and the details of the whole internment experience, like the loyalty questionnaire. So this is, to me,
we look forward to it, indeed. Yeah, it will be an important series to watch. George Takei will be appearing in the second season of AMC's horror series, The Terror, again, begins next month. The new book is called They Called Us Enemy. It was written with Justin Eisinger and Stephen Scott. The art is by Harmony Becker and letters by George Lascano. The graphic memoir was edited by Lee Walton. It's published by Top Shelf Productions. Mr. Takei, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed the conversation.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation with the University of Baltimore Law Professor Kim Whaley. Her new book is a fascinating how-to guide to understanding the United States Constitution. It's called How to Read the Constitution and Why. Kim Whaley is my guest for the hour tomorrow on Midday. Thanks to The Diz for lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner, with breakfast served on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Tom Hall. Here and Now is coming up next after news at the top of the hour. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.